Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, guests, thoughts to help you live a more positively minded life. And in the studio today, my good friend, associate, the Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
Nice to be here, too, huh? Hey, listen, Kent, this is what Kent and I are going to bring you today. We wanted to have a little year-end celebration partially because it's really wonderful what people have been able to do for themselves and how much people have taken care of themselves over the last year. They've taken care of themselves so much in so many different ways. People have learned how to eat right, how to get more fit, how to go to gyms, and it's really beautiful that humans are paying more attention to themselves and leaving less up to some external source.
Yeah, I think that ever since managed care has come in and changed our society since 1990, people haven't been able to rely on physicians so much to educate them about their what's troubling them, what's giving them pain and discomfort, whether it's physical pain and discomfort or psychological pain and discomfort. It's been so hard to access care. And I think it's caused a sort of revolution where people have turned to the internet, turned towards places to get information to sort of find out and educate themselves what's going on with their own bodies and learn how to self-medicate the symptoms and the discomforts they're feeling physically and not necessarily rely on doctors, and as well psychologically and emotionally.
So self-medication is our subject today, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about how people take care of themselves, and we're talking about the good, great stuff that people are doing, and then we're going to talk about some of the caveats, some of the difficulties that people have. Self-medication, I mean, whatever that means really self-monitoring. That really means being able to watch yourself and take care of yourself. In the old days, you know, way back when, if you felt something wrong with your body, who would you go see? You would go see the witch doctor, you know, you would go see whoever was. And then later, after a while, there were so many different kind of doctors around, and we got into the 20th century, and now it went from witch doctor to witch doctor. Which doctor will I go to? Which doctor will I be? And then you became the physician. You became it. That's the only way to get through this, my friends. Most of you learned that you have to do it. Kent talks about managed care. 1991, the handwriting was on the wall. It was the end of my doctor, the phrase my doctor. 1990, managed care was coming in. I remember one friend of mine said, get ready for the next stage. Everything is going to be managed care. And what that meant is that people will no longer be able to say my doctor and feel it. You can't feel that connection anymore because he is too short of time. He treats too many people in order to treat you, and he lives in constant fear. Now, why do physicians live in constant fear? Well, for many reasons, but Kent, maybe you could tell me, as a physician, and you know many of your associates, and you're less scared than most of them I know out there, what do they have to fear? What do they have
to
learn?
They're afraid of a couple of things. One thing that everyone's afraid of is a lawsuit. Everyone's afraid of some sort of malpractice suit against them. So they're treating every patient as a potential lawsuit. And
when you do that, what do? Do you make records?
Yeah, you make records and you act much more conservatively and certainly somewhat defensively. You certainly go to the worst case scenario of what could possibly be wrong with the person because you live in fear that you're going to miss that one in a million sort of odd illness or disease that if you were going to miss that, so you get a lot of testing and work up a lot of things that maybe common sense would tell you and other countries would not necessarily be pursuing, but just that fear again that what should happen if you miss some very strange kind of disorder or illness and then you're facing a lawsuit that could ruin your career.
So a good example of that was a friend of mine had the had a went for a persistent cough to a physician. The physician sent her to get a radium GERD, G-E-R-D, for reflux disease. It's kind of out there, but, you know, it's like this tiny percentage, and what they're doing is they're sending you through testing, which is by most managed care free. You know, you don't even pay a $10 copay because you're getting tested, and this way nobody will be responsible. So one thing is afraid of missing something that could cause you to sue me eventually.
Right.
Not afraid of missing something that's going to make you feel bad.
Right.
Just if could it could be fatal, and you or somebody else around you could sue me.
And then I think the insurance companies, you know, constantly sort of wanting to know people's records, being very wary of what you write down, since they, you know, have the ability to come in and, you know, subpoena or get access to your records and charts. And I think that also makes people much more conservative and much more aware of what they're writing down, and just frightened that, again, that somebody's looking over their shoulder about how they're doing their treatment with somebody.
So physicians have to worry about insurance companies where people are collecting. So the insurance companies, because very often there's a scam. I heard of somebody the other day who was in therapy with somebody, and that somebody kept submitting insurance claims long after the person completed therapy. And when she said, "What are you doing?" she called the person and said, "What are you doing submitting these claims?" The person said that the psychologist actually said, "I'll split the money with you. What are you complaining about?" So there are enough of the insurance companies have to deal with that, which is what creates managed care. But then we have people having to deal with frightened physicians. You know, it should be spelled with a P-H, frightened, P-H-R-I-G-H-T, frightened physicians. Frightened physicians, because they have to be careful for now insurance companies. They have to be careful for being sued. What else do they have to be beware of?
Well, and I also think that their training makes them also less likely to be aware of the other kinds of ways that people can help themselves, you know, with whatever discomforting to them. So I think that the training of doctors, they're just also, again, very used to giving a pill out or something like that. Their own training and background is such that if somebody comes to them with some kind of discomfort, somebody's expecting a prescription for something. And what we'll probably talk about today is lots of times that's not necessarily what's in order with a lot of what causes certainly physical pain, but also emotional pain, that, you know, that it's not necessarily a pill or something that people need. They need to make different changes and choices into their lifestyle and other sorts of things.
So physicians are getting, you know, are more cautious, therefore, and we created this. You know, we it's not that they're bad. We created this by exploiting the whole medical system and getting over, you know, getting a little too comfortable with it. And we are learning to take care of ourselves. Now, here's the problem. Problem is, people are learning to take care of themselves, and they have a number of good... You have to have a couple of things when you're going to take care of yourself. You have to have a good feedback device. You have to know if what you're doing is working. Well, the best feedback device that people generally will use is around pain. If someone has pain, they immediately run and take a medication, and their feedback device tells them if there's immediate alleviation of the pain, then it's working. But, you know, there's a reason why physicians are so limiting in the amount of prescription drugs that they give out. Because they also know that if you take a medication the minute you feel a pain, then you may just become addicted to it in some way.
Right. I think that, you know, again, physically, if you are in some degree of discomfort with a physical pain, or discomfort, whether it's a migraine, whether it's lower back, whether it's stomach, very common sorts of discomforts. And you, as immediately upon feeling some discomfort or pain, you reach for a pill, you're not going to have the sort of pause to sort of sit with it a little bit and ride it out a little bit and then get to the point where you're trying to figure out what other ways can you sort of minimize or diminish the pain other than popping a pill. Because usually when you're at the point where you're taking a pill, you're at a place where nothing else is going to help the discomfort I'm in. And to my thinking, that gets to be a slightly hopeless place where you do have some control with the pill, but there are other ways with many of these things, headaches, stomach, back pains, all sorts of these physical illnesses. There are many, lots of data out there, lots of research out there of other ways people are able to cause these parts of their body to calm down, to relax, to somehow break the cycle that's causing that pain. And if you take a pill, you're never going to learn those kinds of techniques. And so then you're not as empowered as you are if you're then making sort of changes in your behavior, which can then limit the discomfort you're in.
So you don't want to become your own doctor, because the doctors are used to just pushing a pill. They're used to just giving you a pill. Very rarely, I mean, I remember going to a dentist one day, and the dentist told me, is your tooth too sharp over here? And I said, what are you asking me? She said, run over it with your tongue. And I said, well, can't you feel if it's sharp or not? She said, no, I wear gloves. I said, take off your gloves. And you could feel it, as opposed to asking me to feel it with my tongue. Feel it with your finger, you'll find it. And she said, oh, I can't take off my gloves. And I thought, well, that's the way it's become. It's become so she took off her gloves, and she felt like she was committing some great crime to be doing this. It's like doctors can't take off their gloves anymore, so now we become our own doctors. But we have to be very cautious with ourselves and becoming our own doctors, because it's very lonely and very confusing. So this is Armand DeMille with Kent Robert Shore. We're talking about self-medication, and we're talking about it from two angles. One is celebrating it and saying, great, people are learning to take care of themselves, and saying, and there's a downside to it as well, which we will talk about as well.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about certainly emotional pain, again, we want to sort of say that, people who have turned to particularly substances as a way to treat their emotional pain, which is the vast majority of the people I treat, they're just trying to get relief of some very painful anxiety or irritability or blue, sad, or shy, insecure, all these emotional, painful feelings that they have, and they're unable to get any relief. And 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, all of a sudden they feel finally their mood is lifted a little bit, they're a little less tense, they're a little less irritable, they're a little less blue. And it's, today I just saw an article that, again, Vicodin has surpassed marijuana as the number one abused substance by 17 and 18-year-olds. So a lot of those 17, 18-year-olds, I'm convinced, are either going to isolate in their room or even contemplate suicidal thoughts. And when they reach to alcohol, pot, Vicodin, for finally they're getting a sense of relief of some of the emotional psychic pain that's dogged them since they were 10, 11, 12 years old, and they feel more relaxed, more comfortable, and they're able to function better.
It's amazing. It's between Vicodin and, you know, the other thing they do? Starbucks. It's amazing to hang out outside any preschool or pre-high school where the 12 and 13-year-olds go. You can see them coming in so wired, and then they offer they buy these incredible caffeine drinks. Mm-hmm. So now they mix this caffeine or with the one shot, which, that, you know, that Red Bull stuff, that should be an illegal drink. It should be only people over 18. Now you get Red Bull and you mix that with a little coffee, and then you take that and you drop a Vicodin, and then you go back to school.
Right.
And this is 13.
Yeah, and you're finally feeling a little bit better. And for many of these people, normal. They're saying that they're not trying to get high initially often. They're just trying to feel better,
okay,
and fit in and okay. And they're not feeling okay. And they don't know how not to feel this discomfort they're feeling. They don't have any tools. No one's teaching them. No one's talking to them to find out what hurts emotionally. So they're able to deal with their own hurt by reaching towards substances.
We're talking with Dr. Kent Robert Shore, who's a psychiatrist and a physician, of course. And as a physician, he kind of sees this happening. We see people self-medicating, and we're talking about self-medicating. And, of course, self-medicating includes nutrition. That's a form of self-medicating. I mean, everything you put in your body to adjust your chemistry at any given moment, no matter what it is. If you take flaxseed, you know, you're self-medicating. You are saying, I need to adjust my chemistry away from its natural source by adding something to it or taking something away from it because I want it to function differently than it does because I don't like the feeling I have. Now, when people move away from the feeling they have, I could certainly understand it if they have very bad feelings. There are times that they really need to go to a physician or a hospital because they could be... What are the three primary cases of when a person should rush off? I mean, a fear of infection, right?
Yeah, certainly.
You can't treat an infection yourself unless you have the medication handy.
Absolutely. I think there are certain times where, again, all your efforts to educate yourself and get the kind of help and nutritional help and behavioral help, but there are certain things that if you're not feeling much better and you're getting worse, then things like an infection would be something that you really need to consult a doctor to rule out. You're not going to figure that out on your own or treat on your own.
Or a disease.
A major disease like, Crohn's disease or multiple sclerosis or things like that. I mean, these are pretty, these are very powerful, well-known genetic disorders or autoimmune diseases, which, again, you're probably not going to be able to figure out and find any kind of relief or symptom relief, really, I think, without getting to a professional.
Well, even just figuring it out, you need the testing devices that they have. You don't have, we can't get by a testing device for Crohn's disease.
Right.
We can't. So we need them for certain things. And then what we've learned is that because managed care is so difficult and a lot of people don't have insurance and they can't afford to pay for managed care, people have been using, emergency rooms for this. Now I learned a secret about emergency rooms from a physician the other day. He said, if you got a serious problem and you don't have any money, go to an emergency room at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I gave that advice to someone who went to an emergency room at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they said it was like walking into the best possible hospital. He said, you walked in, there was nobody being treated. They welcomed you in. There were physicians standing around. They ran you right through. They took care of you. He said it was like one of the best experiences he ever had, 5 in the morning in an emergency room. Right. They're waiting around. Hopefully you bring them donuts because it's the all-night shift.
That's right.
You know, and make yourself well-known, But, you know, he said, so you learn to take care of yourself this way. But now getting to what you're saying, beyond, finding the diagnosis of what you have, once you know what you have and once you try to take care of it yourself, there are things that get in the way. And this is, we're going to move along from psychological, physical to psychological pain. There are two things that will drive you to make decisions just based on the impulse at the moment. And the one is going to be, of course, physical pain, and the other is emotional pain spiking. Now, it's very important with the spikes.
Well, I think, again, when people have JAGs or, overwhelming feelings of emotional pain, there's a sense that it's not going to get better, it's not going to go away. There's a feeling like, how long is this going to last? This feeling of anger, this feeling of sadness, this feeling of anxiety. So when you're in the moment, it can feel like you're going to suffer eternally with whatever painful emotion you're in that moment. And so that's why there can sometimes be such a pull to reaching for something very quickly, very quick, sort of relief of this. And obviously there's the category we're talking about in terms of like an addictive thing with pills and the like. Some would say also that the same kind of thing would be true with, running towards the internet and video games or pornography or going to donuts or going to food or something like that. So if we're going to say that people learn to go towards a self-medicating of a pain that they're in, there are the pills and the alcohol and the chemicals.
And the behaviors.
And right. Then there are the behaviors as well. But both coming from a fact that somebody's unable to sit with this discomfort, and they need to quickly and rapidly sort of relieve this pain that they're in, with a sense that I think is that it's not going to get better anytime soon, and there's nothing else I can do to relieve myself of this pain.
It just seems natural, Kent, that people have a feedback system that says if there is a spike of pain, you must do something about it. It just seems like it's almost like a biological imperative. The biological imperative being that, oh, sharp pain means do something to get away. So if a person has a pain that becomes a sharp pain, and that could be an emotional pain as well, they're immediately looking for solution. Now, most people who have emotional pain, the mind looks like it would just naturally look. If you feel a lot of anxiety and a lot of pain, your body goes into some kind of sympathetic overload. It says there's danger here. There must be an enemy somewhere. And so what you do naturally is you pick a fight with somebody. You have an argument. You get angry. Anger is one way to avoid feeling pain, because that's what any animal would do who's hurt. You know, an animal's hurt, it roars, it screams, it attacks, and it doesn't feel the pain. It could numb it down. So one of the things that you would know as you learn about your own self-medication is that if you see yourself getting angry and irritable, it's a good thing, because this is a clue that there's something behind it. Now, I know the bravest of people who challenge that and they don't take it too far. But with many couples, if you walk in and start screaming at your kids and your kids start screaming and then your husband starts screaming back at you, it becomes a kind of a cycle. And it becomes, the addictive nature becomes the screaming battle as a way of avoiding your emotional pain. All of this says one thing to us. It all says that wherever there is a spike in physical pain or in emotional pain, somewhere you got to learn, or if you could learn, to ride it through, you will become better at taking care of yourself, which will include a kind of self-medicating that doesn't involve medication. You know, very often you'll be able to go through, because if you reach for something immediately and you take a drink or you eat food, that becomes the standard for the next time. That becomes the basis of all addiction. Armand D'Amelio with Kent Robert Shaw. We also talked, Kent, about the role of the mate, of the other partner, when you have a partner who's going through extreme pain. There are a lot of dangers in that role, you know. I mean, what do you see as primary problems?
Well, I think one of the things that happens with both physical pain and emotional pain is that the other person maybe comes into a rescue mode or a fix-it mode, rather than what I think is most helpful is if the partner comes in more an empathic, supportive sort of one to help the person verbalize their feelings about the certainly the emotional and their physical pain that they're in, but not necessarily step into the category of caretaking and making it okay or trying to fix it. Certainly the studies about physical pain would show that one of the destructive things about people empowering themselves to get through their chronic pain is to, in fact, not have their partners and caretakers start doing everything for them. Things that may cause slight discomfort may actually be part of the healing process and may be actually helpful for people.
Like an example of that, if a person's got a hurt system and they say, would you get me this or would you get me that, it might be actually better for you to get up and get it yourself. So one of the things you're recommending is that a partner do not facilitate an illness. You know, like you try to let that person have their own strength. That's what they do in hospitals, don't they? I mean, they leave you wait for a while so that you could get through it each time.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, emotionally as well, you know, people, again, will somehow just try to fix the problem that the person is experiencing, which, again, is kind of infantilizing in a way, like a parent, as opposed to a more mature adult-to-adult interaction, which would be, you know, let me just listen to and let me have you communicate and express your emotions or feelings about what's troubling you rather than me go out and yell at the person who just hurt you. Let me talk to you about it. And maybe by your just being able to verbalize the emotional pain you're feeling, you're going to get some symptom relief. You know, you're going to get something to feel good. So one person would come in and have a drink if they were hurt by a cab driver as they walk in a door. Another person, as Armand would say, hurt people hurt people. So since I feel hurt, I'll come in and hurt my spouse, and that will discharge that hurt with anger. So I'll feel less small, weak, and helpless by hurting my partner. The third, and I think the most positive and most healthy response, would be to come in, not necessarily isolate and work through your own feelings of hurt, but use the person to talk about how you felt about it. And I think there is something very powerful about when a human being talks to another human being about some hurt or sad or anxiety they're feeling, and having the other person just listen and seem to care, that lightens people's moods.
I think you're right. I think the important thing here is learning that even if the person says, help me, that it's okay to say, I can't help you, but I'll be here.
Mm-hmm.
See, what happens to a lot of us, though, if you grow up in a family where you have a sick parent, very often you think, help me, and you think, you really believe as a child that you have the power to help your parent. They actually convince you. And so you get stuck in that thing of, I must be able to help you. But you're far better off having somebody there with you than being alone with your pain. It's so nice. So it's not that there's something wrong with the person being there. It's just that the role of the person being there is to be there. And even if the person you're with starts turning against you and yelling at you, you see them in pain. They're in pain. They're hurting. Whatever they may be doing that's targeted on you at the moment, you can get past this. You know, they're the ones who are hurting a great deal. It's part of an act of love. It's part of what loving is. So this is Armand DeMille with Kent Robert Shore. We're talking about self-medicating, and we're going to continue talking about this because so many people nowadays are put into this role and are adopting it so well. I mean, they're doing so well in learning research, being able to go to if somebody prescribes a medication, look up that medication online, make sure you check it out, make sure you know the goods and the bads and what could possibly happen. If somebody tells you a procedure, look up that procedure and you learn more. And people are doing that. People are learning to take care of themselves, except in some cases, some people are just not being very efficient at it. And when we get back from our break, we're going to talk about some of those disorders, especially the psychiatric ones, that become very difficult to do on your own. Even though we would prefer that you do it on your own, even though we're in the business of helping you with it, you know what I mean? But it's kind of, you know, we've got to talk about why you, as a doctor, as a physician, don't return all your phone calls. We got to talk about that when we come back. We got to talk about why doctors don't always call back. And when we come back after our break, we're going to address many more issues like this, because I am with the brave and courageous Kent Robert Shore, who tells the truth. Be back with you in a couple of minutes.
Thank you.
that's the wonderful piano of Vince Guaraldi, Jitterbug Waltz. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with your WBAI 99.5 FM. We are with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, and we're talking about self-medication, which is a very important subject nowadays, because people have taken control of their medical self and their health, and people are living longer. They're going to the gyms, they're working out, they're fixing their bodies, they're making themselves feel better. And in order to do that, they've had to shift the attention away from being dependent on physicians to attention on themselves. So people are taking care of themselves. The trouble with it is there are certain times that you run into troubles with it, and you want to be able to reach somebody who's an authority. Right before the break, I mentioned to Kent, I said, Kent, I want you to talk about why you can't always return your calls, because one of the complaints you always hear about physicians, almost every physician, is that they don't return their calls. You know, every one of them. I know one good friend of mine who's a physician. He returns calls only on Tuesday nights. What if you need him on Monday? What if you need him on Wednesday? You got to wait a whole week, but he only returns calls on Tuesday nights, which is a very funny thing. So let's go with this question about telephone calls. It's very important. There you are, a physician. You get like 100 calls. How many calls do you get on your machine?
Oh, there. While I'm here right now, I came over at 12:30. I'll get back at 2. I could have 11 to 15 phone calls waiting for me when I walk in to my office when I'm done with the show today. And so, you know,
I remember, by the way, I had a guy here who was a holistic physician, and he had a beeper. And he had a beeper that was, this is back in the days of beepers. And he looked down, and he was a holistic physician. And every time the beeper went off, it was like a little vibrate. And he looked at me, and he said, that's 121. I said, 121 what? He said, 121 calls waiting for me. And he said it almost like with a disdain. Like, now they don't even count anymore. Now they're just numbers that are adding up. They're just people coming after me.
Yeah, I think, you know, so what I do is, I think a lot of people in their businesses, I do the same thing, which is, you know, given the calls you get, not that I have to go into session, I have to see people, and I'm not Superman, I can't be cloned by treating people as well as returning calls. I have to prioritize. I have to sort of hit on what I perceive are the more important ones, given the nature of the message I'm getting on the machine and the like. So that's what I do. And some have to wait. If there's no sense of urgency that I get that it's an immediate problem, it'll wait till tomorrow, you know. And I think that that's how I will not get back to people within that day, because there's just not enough time. And I've tried to pick the ones that I think are more of a crisis nature, and the ones that I see can hopefully wait till a day, I will try to get back to, you know, then the next day.
Well, you know, there are, Ken, I can only say from my side of it, being the manager of a mental health center and having an email where people are really available to me, or I'm available to people, sometimes I look at the emails that come in, and I get hundreds every day. If they don't get spammed out, I get many. And I look at them, and some of them are just great, just great. I mean, people writing, telling about themselves. But I do the same thing. I have to prioritize which ones am I going to respond to. I'm going to respond to some and not to others. Now, this is a problem that I know must happen with you, because it happens with me. After a while, the one that's down at the bottom of the list, like call my pharmacy and check with him about something where you're being given a task to do, that becomes at the bottom of your list compared to the other ones that become critically important, and you may forget to do it.
Yeah, certainly I would say that call your pharmacy I tend to do. Pretty clearly, because people, I would say it's a crisis if they run out of medication. Call my pharmacy and then call me back when you call my pharmacy. That second step, you know, I must, to be really honest, I'm not perfect. I've called the pharmacy. I've taken care of the medication. I may not call back because I assume the patient can also call the pharmacy themselves and see that I had called. So to allow someone to go a day without medication, to my Jimmy the Cricket, would be unacceptable, to not get the medication in, to have to then take the next step to call them back, to tell them I've called in. Maybe I won't do, because I know they can themselves take care of themselves and call the pharmacy and see that I've called in. They know if I've called in the pharmacy.
So you want to put on a physician as few tasks as possible, knowing that they have to be expedient. Like, I saw somebody who saw a physician the other day. The physician had 5 minutes in between sessions and gave the person only 5 minutes, and they resented it was only 5 minutes. But that was the nature of the beast. It's a lung doctor. It's in the middle of the winter. We have people dying right and left. You have a non-life-threatening illness. He's got 5 minutes. It is a precious 5 minutes. Not that you should think the doctor should be great for giving you the 5 minutes, but that's all he has. He doesn't have more than that. He doesn't have this extra time to talk to you on the phone. So it's part of what self-medication is understanding that you want a good relationship with as many people that you use in your medication circuit. That includes, you want a good relationship with your nutritionist. You want a good relationship with your exercise place. You want a good relationship. Well, you want good relationships. In fact, the more good relationships you have, the less you're going to need medication anyway. So part of the focus of this is you want a good relationship with your physician, and that doesn't mean kissing their butt. But it means that if you're going to deal with them, deal with what you know about them, and deal with them with full respect with what they go through, their fears of lawsuits and all the other stuff, see them the way they are, and try to maximize your benefits by being somebody who they do not perceive as a pain in the butt. Because once the people who you are going to for help see you as a royal pain, you get very bad treatment. If your drugstore doesn't like you and you're going there for medication, boy, you may never get your medications, because they get angry, these people. If the secretary who doesn't like you from your physician's office, he never gets your messages. So you have a job. If you're going to employ people in the circuit who are going to help you out, you got to be nice. You just do. You have to be polite. There's a way of doing it. Now, one thing I would like to know, though, is how can somebody get your attention when they feel this panic, like it is an emergency for them, even though you don't think it's an emergency for them? Could they say, is it a wise idea to call every physician and saying, I feel like killing myself unless you call me back? Maybe out of fear of being sued what's a good idea?
What's the trick?
If somebody
calls me up and says, hi, it's been 2 weeks, I've been on medication X, and call me back, then that doesn't get my attention, as I have some rash that is now creeping up my trunk and I have a fever of 101. So again, the nature of the call, if it's this, I've been on the meds, give me a buzz back, I may get to that tomorrow, because it seems like a kind of routine follow-up, call me after 2 or 3 weeks, as opposed to I'm having some very uncomfortable side effect that I hear on my answering machine that alerts me that there's something very troublesome going on.
So what do you need to do? Be very specific. What do you need to do when you call somebody to get their attention? You want to sound like you're not hysterical, right? Because hysteria automatically gets, in some way, reduces the responsiveness. If a person's hysterical, you kind of look at that and go, oops, okay, I'll get to this one. This one's going to take a lot of energy. What do you prefer? If it's too calm, you're not going to go there anyway. If the person sounds that solid, you're not going to go there. What do you need to do for a person to believe that they will get a response, because you will believe that they deserve a response? How do they deliver their sense of urgency? Do you hear what I'm saying? How do you manipulate your doctors?
Well, I think the squeaky wheel gets the oil. I think you want to sort of, you know, and I think calling back a second time, you know, being persistent like that, I guess some people...
So a little hysteria works.
Yeah, I think, again, some people may say I shouldn't have to call twice, you know, that's enough. But again, if you have this sense of urgency, then if you called 9 in the morning and it's 3 in the afternoon and you really are uncomfortable, then, you know, you could stand on principle and get your nose out of joint that the doctor hasn't called you back. Or you could take an action to call a second time to, by the nature of there being two calls in one day, would also get the attention of the doctor. Or, you know, I have the same thing in my life with my accountant, or if I'm doing a legal case or something like that, it's the same thing. You know, if I really need to know something, I will then call again. And I assume that just the fact that I've called twice will, even if I do it kind of calmly, will suggest that, you know, I need this information quickly.
Well, I think one of the things that I've also learned with patients who tend to overuse communication, you know, I know one therapist is treating somebody who has a kind of a panic-based disorder, and one of the things they found is that the person writes so many emails complaining and yelling and so many phone calls that they begin to ignore the person after a while. They just have to. So you can't be so squeaky a wheel that you eventually get off the therapist's radar. They just say, that's it, I can't deal with that person. But I'm not going to tell them I can't deal with them because I'm afraid of them, so I'm just going to ignore them. You have to be somewhere in there, somewhere in the middle of that. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's another thing I want to talk about, which is, Kent, this whole idea of attention and intention when it comes to your own physical well-being. If you're going to take care of yourself, if you're going to be okay with yourself, one of the two major things that you need as feedback is attention and intention. One thing, for example, is to know your intention. If your intention is to get over a cold, and you want to get over a flu, right? You want to get over a flu. That's your intention. But you want to do it without taking medications that are going to cost you long term by building up your resistance to antibiotics. You just want to get through it. You need to pay attention to your body. You have to know that you have fevers. You know that you have things happening. You can keep your regulators working. And you stay with your intention, which is to ride it through. You're going to go through it. And even though it gets uncomfortable, you're going to go through it. So intention is something that you have to plan, and you have to plan it in the middle of discomfort, but not when you're just at the points where it's a, you have to do it in calm times. What is my intention? I want to get off this medication. How do I get off this medication? I'm going to take time. I'm going to read about it. I slowly decrease this medication. What is my attention? My attention is to pay attention to all the things that I'm going on through and see how they match up with what I've read about withdrawal from this substance that I've been taking. I pay attention to what's going on in my body, and if I feel like I'm about to crawl out of my skin, I go back to my intention. My intention is to make myself drug-free and medication-free. So both intention and attention are the things that help you ride through things to make things go to a place where you could actually take care of yourself better. Now, there are certain disorders, and there are certain, especially stuff I want to talk specifically about the bipolar disorder people and how they deal with this intention and attention. They can't do it. Right? Why is that? Because we want to talk about it, Jeff, for a quick second. We got a few minutes.
Well, again, I think that people with bipolar, you know, their disorder, they're often, you know, having tremendous overwhelming emotions. So one of the things that's problematic with people with bipolar is because their feelings and emotions get to such an extreme state and such a peak state that they're hardly able to withstand, you know, thinking what their intention is and riding through these peaks, as we said before the break, of sort of being able to sit through some emotional pain and sit through physical pain we talked about, but also in terms of bipolar, it's primarily emotional pain that they're feeling.
Let's describe what bipolar is to the people who don't know. That's also known as manic depressive illness. It's
people that have a propensity to have extreme emotional swings, often into very painful places. Again, manic depression. Everyone thinks manic, and they think, oh, that's a great happy thing, like Robin Williams. He's wired and happy and full of life and the like. Mania is not often like that. Mania often has a very irritable, slightly paranoid, agitated feel. Like
frenzy.
A motor running. Robin Williams has a kind of zippy motor running. A lot of bipolars have an agitated, antsy, you know, can't sit still, kind of needs to pace, it just feels agitated. It's not a pleasant feeling at all. So these people, because their states are so extreme, they may have more difficulty than other people to sit through these kinds of emotional states. And it's why we find out a lot of people with addictions, particularly addictions to sort of calming kinds of substances like marijuana, alcohol, as well as, sedatives and narcotics, they gravitate to things because they can't sit through these emotional storms that may be more severe and not let up as well with calm, with introspection, maybe even a phone call to a caring friend. They're biologically in these states that are very long and very uncomfortable, and again, they find that they can get relief like that. Now, ironically, a lot of these people who have these kind of hyper-excitable states also gravitate towards caffeine and Starbucks and stimulants, because sometimes those states are kind of pleasurable when they're revved up, and when they kind of swing down, bipolar implying mood swings, when they swing into normal or depression, they really miss that kind of, at least the happy, the energized feeling, and so they want to recapture that, and so they feel very upset when they're not feeling that energy anymore, and they gravitate towards cocaine or caffeine.
So part of what we're learning is that there are certain emotional conditions, especially the ones that include what they would call the histrionic or the very nervous or the agitated or the angry, that when you have that, it is very difficult. It's like you're plugged into the wall at all times. You know, it's like you're an electric fan. They got you plugged in. You can't unplug. So when you can't unplug, you don't have your right mind to make decisions. You only have panic decisions. You only have decisions based on panic. And when decisions are based on panic, what people do is they go to their partners. They bring up an issue. The partners deal with the issue. The partners get angry at them. Maybe you'll work it through, but what a person needs at that point is they need someone to listen, someone to be calm, someone to be not reactive, someone to be not advising, someone to be accepting of their state, and then someone who could eventually say to them, you know, if this doesn't ride its way through, maybe we have to do something else about it. But support becomes different than what you think it is, because when a person is in this hypermanic, agitated, angry state, they feel like a wild animal who's just lost in the world. I mean, my heart goes out to you. You know, I could feel what that's like. No matter what it's like, you need someone to love you, and it's so hard to find, because at the same time you're biting the hand that feeds you. You know, at the very time. So even you'll call up your physicians and scream at them. And if you're somebody like Kent, you know, he's dedicated and he cares and he says, okay, you can scream at me. Let's continue on here. Let's keep going. But a lot of people, they just won't be bothered. You know, a lot of physicians will just, boom, I'm not going to talk to that person. I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to leave it. I'm going to make sure I don't get sued, but I'll just keep my record straight and I won't return the call. So it really takes quite a bit of knowledge and information. If you're going to treat yourself, my friends, do so. You know, do so and be fine with it. Use your resources as best you can. Find the physicians who you could trust, who you could at least depend on for something. Find maybe you need a dozen different ones for a dozen different things. And trust somebody you care about also, and trust yourself. And learn to sit through the spikes of emotional and physical pain. That's kind of the bottom line of it. And Kent, I think that that's a great contribution to people. And if people wanted to hear this program again, or if they wanted to download it or look for it on the internet, they could go to thepositivemind.com And you may want to just forward it to somebody you know who goes through this a great deal. I want to thank you so much for being with me again, Kent. As usual, perfect.
Pleasure. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Wonderful, wonderful. We will be back with you, my friends, on Thursday, tomorrow, at 1 p.m. with more good stuff. Here's more Vince Garavi.